What happens when an elite team of mercenaries breaks into a family compound on Christmas Eve, taking everyone hostage? But they aren't prepared for a surprise combatant. Santa Claus is on the grounds, and he's about to show why this Nick ain't so saint. Of course, I'm talking about Violent Night. We're going to be breaking it down here today on Podio Commentary. Hi, my name is Matt Jarbo. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we are going to be talking about Violent Night. This is an episode I wanted to get out before Christmas just because of, you know, it dealing with Christmas and Santa Claus and all that jazz. But hey, listen, snowstorms, they're a real problem. Once in a generation, snowstorms make it very difficult to focus on the work you want to do. So we are where we are. But man, this is one that I was going to delay talking about for a while just because I don't want to focus on new movies all the time on the show. I like to be able to go into the nitty gritty of how things get made. And so a new movie doesn't always have that information out there. If it's a big movie, like a big tentpole film like Avatar, yeah, a lot of that how it's made information is already out there in the public space. But when it comes to something like Violent Night, it is definitely not something that's going to get talked about a great deal, even though it should, because the movie is amazing. So why don't we just dive in? We'll just break right into this here and start talking about how Violent Night came together. So first, let's talk about the writer and the director. So the movie was written by Pat Casey and Josh Miller. These two have worked together since they were literal teenagers. And I think the first movie they actually worked together on was National Lampoon's Dorm Days, where Pat Casey acted in the film and Josh Miller wrote that, as well as the sequel. The two actually then went on, and I don't know how this happened, but they did. They went on to develop and write both of the Sonic the Hedgehog movies. And I think watching this movie and looking at some of the commentary and some of the things that are in it and how it definitely feels like a film that was birthed out of the late 80s and early 90s and brought into now, some of the Sonic the Hedgehog commentary kind of feels like the humor feels very similar, which is totally fine with me because I love and adore both of the Sonic films. And this movie is just right up there with one of the better ones I've seen this year. And this, the director, though, is a very interesting choice and one that I think was really brilliant to bring on in. It was Tommy Wirkola, who you may know from having done Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. Well, you may not actually know that one. A Jeremy Renner, Gemma Arterton movie that came out a number of years back. You might know, if you're a horror fan, the other two movies this guy is known for, which, of course, is Dead Snow and Dead Snow 2. Yeah, a whole bunch of Nazi zombies in the Norwegian forest fighting a bunch of other people. Look, this guy knows how to do kind of close combat scenarios up against really crazy odds. And that's basically what this whole movie is about. Now, the movie stars David Harbour as Santa Claus, John Leguizamo as a robber slash terrorist slash Hans Gruber stand-in named Scrooge, Alex Hassel, Alexis Lauder, Edie Patterson, Cam Gigonet, Lee Brady, and of course, Beverly D'Angelo in a role that feels very suited for her voice. Really, if you know her voice, like I was thinking back the other day about the National Lampoon's Christmas. So of course, it's Christmas time. So I was watching some clips of it online and you hear Beverly D'Angelo talk. You hear her, you know, Clark, you hear her talk. And then now it's like, Clark, you're like, oh my God, man, look, I'm an ex-smoker. I quit smoking back in 2006. My voice, you know, is deeper as it is, but man, her voice puts mine to shame. And I'm not knocking it. I think it really works for the kind of character, the matriarch of the family that she played. So let's talk a little bit here about how Violent Night came together. Because like I said, there's not a lot of information about the movie, but I was able to find a recent interview with Entertainment Weekly where Pat Casey and Josh Miller discussed how they came up with the initial concept for Violent Night. And this actually goes all the way back to when they were in high school back in Icy, Minnesota. So if you start to think about that, these are two guys who've been friends since they were teens. They worked on a local, you know, a public access channel. All right. They knew all about this stuff from back in the day. They come up with a concept when they're kids. Hey, what if Santa Claus is like Die Hard, right? What if Santa Claus is John McClane and he has to like save a family that's been taken captive by freaking thieves? It's an awesome concept to come up with when you're 14. I came up with similar ideas when I was 14. And look, the beauty of this is that they were actually able to take that, and they were able to take it and develop it into a movie that is just great. And so it's such a simple concept, and it does feel, I don't want to say rather pedestrian, but it reminds me of when The Fifth Element was coming out, right? And there was like the movie trivia slides before you'd go see a movie. For all of you who don't remember what it was like before Newvie, okay, we had projector slides that would be like, here's your trivia of the week sort of thing. And back then, you know, there was one of them that talked about how Luc Besson came up with the idea of Fifth Element when he was only a teenager. And it took him that long to develop it into the film it was back in 1997. So sometimes these ideas come to kids when they're younger and they just hold on to them, because you never know when that kind of childlike innocence in a story is going to be able to really capture audiences. And again, when I look at, let's say, Fifth Element, you look at like it from Lilu's perspective, childlike. Here, the young girl who is, you know, believes in Santa, and Santa's having a crisis of faith, very much has that innocence about her. And it's something that I really, really, really enjoy. So like I said, they came up with this idea before they ever got their first break in the film business. And it was well before, like years and years and years before Universal even like bothered to take a look at them. Now, after they became well-known in the industry, thanks to the hits like National Lampoon Presents Dorm Days, That was a thing I'd found online. That was a passage I'd found online. Look, I enjoyed the National Lampoon's movies, but I don't know if I'd say Dorm Days and Dorm Days 2 really qualify as being like super popular. But the Sonic franchise absolutely does. The two of them, when they found out they had the success from the last Sonic movie, they decided to go to their agent and tell them about this long dormant teen fantasy, right? This John McClane meets Santa Claus type movie. And you know what? The agent actually ran with it. Crazy, right? The agent ran and told a production company about it. And then the next day, they got a call asking if they wanted to pitch it to David Leitch, the director of Deadpool 2, Atomic Blonde, Hobbs and Shaw, co-director of John Wick 1. And they're like, yeah. In fact, actually, the way that they say it is they weren't prepared to pitch it because they just had a concept, right? But in Hollywood, you never say, no, I can't do it. You just say, yes, I'll be there when tomorrow. Awesome. And I mean this too, like, this happened to me a decade ago. I had got brought in to a small company called Aldamisa in Studio City, and they wanted me to work on a movie that they were coming out with at the time. And they were like, okay, we're getting ready to film it in Russia, and we need, can you read the script, and can you come in tomorrow and pitch us a full viral marketing campaign? And I'm like, what? And like, yeah, I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, no problem. Absolutely, 100%. So they sent me the script. I read it that night on my little netbook. I had a little 7-inch netbook, and I'm in my apartment in North Hollywood, and I'm cranking away on this netbook trying to come up with a concept that I can take to their board the next day and pitch them this movie. And I did it, and they hired me, and then they had no budget and wanted me to do everything myself, and the whole thing ultimately fell apart. By the way, Tubi, you can check out Devil's Pass, because that's the movie I'm talking about. Rennie Harlan directed sequel, point of view found footage sequel to the Dyatlov Pass incident, a real life incident back in the late 1950s in Russia. Anyway, I'm off on another tangent here, but I'm just saying, like, in these moments, yeah, no, if someone comes knocking on your door, it's like the line from Ghostbusters, right? Ray, if someone asks if you're a god, you answer yes. Same concept here. So they end up spending the entire day getting ready, right? And they went and met David Leitch for lunch. He was very impressed. And then with his blessing, with his help, they were actually able to send it out as a pitch to the studios. And then they were able to get David Harbour on board. Now, according to David Harbour, part of the appeal of the film is that it doesn't use violence for the sake of using violence. I mean, the movie is very violent, but the violence feels like it's done reluctantly. What I mean by that is that it feels like you're watching him fight for his life, essentially, and things just kind of happen. And then some of the kills, yeah, definitely. Like, it gets pretty crazy as he's trying to, like, not get into the fight. But then once he decides to get into the fight, yeah, all bets are off, man. The violence. Oh, the violence is there for violence's sake. But one of the things that really brought Harbour to the role, obviously, was the heart behind all of it. And the movie does have an insane amount of heart. David Harbour brings a lot to it on that front. I really enjoyed how he presented Santa, how he portrayed him. And it wasn't like a cynical, bitter, nihilistic Santa, kind of like what we saw with Mel Gibson in Fat Man, which is another Christmas classic that I love. But this was more like just circumstances of society have weighed upon Santa to the point of where he's just like, F it. I don't care anymore. I'm just going through the motions. Maybe it's time I quit. And then, you know, it puts him in the path of meeting this little girl that simply just kind of brings the faith back out on him. You know, because it says here, like, first, Santa doesn't want anything to do with it, but then there's a little girl who has a radio to him, and he wants to save her. And that's really the core idea of the movie. It's just Santa wants to help the little girl who believes in him. And again, it works out really, really, really well, considering everyone else in the family are just terrible. They're just terrible people. Now, I did look up some trivia about the movie. I was trying to figure it out because obviously, like, there's not a lot of information about the movie right now. But one of the things IMDb says is that the saint which Santa Claus is based on is Saint Nicholas, obviously. And he was famous for a fight at the Council of Nicaea. Now, here's where it gets a little bit weird, because I spent probably way more time than necessary trying to fact check this. Wikipedia doesn't have that information, but apparently, like, other websites do. So it is kind of take with it what you will. But here's what we know from just general history. Saint Nicholas was a Christian bishop and a saint who lived in the 4th century AD in the region of what is now known as Turkey. He was known for his generosity and his kindness, especially towards children. According to legend, he was born to a wealthy family and became a bishop at a young age. He was known for his acts of charity, such as giving secret gifts to those in need, and he became a patron saint of children and sailors. Saint Nicholas is the basis for the modern-day figure of Santa Claus, and his feast is celebrated on December 6th. Now, the Council of Nicaea was apparently significant, a ecumenical council, which is a gathering of bishops and other church leaders, that was held in the year 325 in the city of Nicaea, which was then part of the Roman Empire. And it was called the Roman Emperor Constantine, who had hoped to resolve certain controversies within the Christian church and to establish a common set of beliefs among Christians throughout the empire. So, you know, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition sort of situation. That's all I can really find on it. According to one website, apparently, like, Saint Nicholas got into a brouhaha and they beat him up, basically, is what it was. But there's no other information on that. So if these guys just read about Saint Nicholas getting into a fight at the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century, it's one of those things that they just held on to. But I can't find a basis for it. Either way, though, it makes a cool story, right? Like, you know, like this Santa Claus, he scraps. He knows how to throw down, you know? Like, you don't want this smoke, son. I could imagine him saying in this, you know, this council chamber. You know, obviously pulling out 2022 dialect back in 4th century AD. But anyway, I digress. After getting the movie put together and after getting David Leitch's company, 87 North Productions, on board, Universal ponied up the $20 million for the budget, and the filming took place January to March 2022 in Winnipeg. So they shot the movie at the beginning of the year, and they had it out by the end of the year, and that makes sense. It's a very simple, very self-contained story that has a fair amount of practical effects in regards to blood, but, you know, and it does have some CG, but they really didn't, you know, have to rely on that too much, so they were able to crank this out pretty quick. So let's talk about the plot a little bit here, because this is where I really enjoy the opening of the movie. So the opening of the movie obviously starts on Christmas Eve. Santa Claus ends up at a pub in Bristol, and he's just getting drunk. And he's reflecting on the fact that children have become more materialistic in a world where they simply just don't believe on him. And he ends up, like, talking with another Santa who basically says, like, oh, we do it for the same reason, the money. And he's like, oh, greed, great. you know. But the guy was nice enough to cover his tab, and he ends up going up to the roof, getting on the sleigh and taking off. And the barmaid comes up to go see him, thinking he might jump or something. And he ends up puking all over her and taking off. And I thought that was a really funny way of showcasing that, like, he simply just doesn't care. Like, he's doing his job. He's just going through the motions. He's got a couple hours to kill while you've got the time change between England and the U.S. And so he decides to stop off at a bar and just get wasted. Then it fast forwards to Greenwich, Connecticut, in which case we meet Jason Lightstone, his wife Linda, and their daughter Trudy, and they're on their way to go visit Jason's mother Gertrude to celebrate Christmas Eve. What I enjoyed about this was, like, the family is dysfunctional. We know that the family is dysfunctional, but Linda is his estranged wife, and they, you know, she loves her husband, but she doesn't like that he feels like he's controlled by his mother, because Beverly D'Angelo plays the matriarch, as I mentioned, and she is just controlling and everyone's afraid of her, but everybody wants her to give them money and everyone wants them to take care of her. Jason doesn't. Like, he feels indebted to his mom from, like, what I could gather, but he absolutely wants to get away because to him, his wife Linda and his daughter Trudy, all short for Gertrude, if you've catched on that this is kind of what they do, that he just wants to get away. He's like, I don't care anymore about the money. That's not what's important. It's what's important is the family. And that is something that, like, is, I think, a good grounding for the family in general, right? Like, as I was watching this movie, I kept thinking back to The Ref, Dennis Leary, Kevin Spacey, Annette Bening, mid-90s film, classic Christmas movie. So good. You guys should check it out. But Dennis Leary is a thief who breaks in to, he's on the run from the cops. He breaks into the house dressed as Santa, ends up kind of taking over this family dinner, this very dysfunctional family on Christmas Eve, and kind of ends up bonding with the family and kind of ends up, like, helping them become, you know, like, they all kind of become better people to an extent. But this movie has a bit of a vibe of that where, like, the family is just terrible outside of Jason and Linda and Trudy. Like, the family is just god awful. And I was wondering, like, are we going to get redeeming factors out of these people as the movie progresses? The movie is not the longest, so I didn't think that there would be a fair amount of that, but they try to an extent, and I give them a little bit of credit on that one there. But as the night progresses, you know, Trudy is still believing in Santa Claus, and even though no one else in the family does, Jason needs to give her a gift, you know, that one gift to open up on Christmas Eve, if I recall correctly. And so he gives her this this walkie-talkie that he had when he was a kid and tells her this can talk to Santa Claus. But unbeknownst to Trudy, Santa makes his way to the compound and he ends up landing on the roof and ends up passing out drunk in one of their lounges, right? As Scrooge, led by John Leguizamo, the whole team comes on in, takes everything over. And what I enjoy about that was, like, as David Harbour is trying to get out of there, as Santa is trying to get out of there, spooks the reindeers, they take off, he's on his own. As the bad guys are doing a sweep, he ends up fighting one of the guys, kicking him out the window, and that guy gets stabbed by a, you know, an icicle, right? Like a troglodyte? What's the one that comes up from the bottom? And as soon as you see that, because they show it early on as, like, you know, people are patrolling the outside of the house, you see that specific device, and I'm like, oh yeah, someone's going to die on that thing. Like, they don't really, like, the movie's not subtle. Let's be fair. The movie's not subtle. They want you to know things are going to get bleak for those who go up against Saint Nick. And I really actually quite enjoyed that. So as, like, the night progresses and, you know, Santa Claus ends up, like, finding the headset and talking to Trudy, she basically starts to kind of, reaffirm his faith in himself by believing in him and by asking him to help her. And he was reluctant at first, but then decides, you know what, like, okay, I'll do it. And through the process of everything, there's a great moment where they recreate Home Alone. And that, to me, that had the audience in my theater going crazy. Because at the beginning part of the movie, when we first are introduced to Jason, Linda, and Trudy, Linda says that Trudy watched Home Alone twice. and, you know, named it by name. And I thought that was kind of interesting because that's like a Fox movie or now a Disney movie, but they're mentioning it in a Universal film. Okay, cool. And then when she runs up into the attic and she hides in the attic, she tells Santa, like, I know what to do. I can set some booby traps. And he basically goes like, yeah, that's cool. Not even thinking about Home Alone, not even thinking that her booby traps would be anything like Home Alone. And I grew up watching Home Alone. The first one came out when I was 8 years old. I've seen it multiple times as a kid and even as an adult because I have my own two daughters now. And what she does in that moment was so damn funny because it finally showcased what would happen to Harry and Marv if Home Alone was real and Kevin McAllister actually was able to pull it off in that fashion. Those people would be dead. One guy gets it specifically in a bad way. And I thought that was hysterical because it's just like, yeah, this is what happens. This is what would happen. And the audience was very happy about that because I think it also played into that conversation that many of us have had either externally or internally when talking about Home Alone. Like, what would happen if we laid all these booby? Like, if he got hit in the head with a paint can, would he just die? How would it crush his skull? Like, how bad, you know, would a brick to the face hurt? Those kind of things. And here it kind of shows it. And it does it in a way that, I mean, I don't know if I say 100% realistic, but it feels pretty real. You know what I mean? It's a fair amount of movie magic when you're watching that. Because you're like, oh yeah, that's how it would go. And then from there, like Santa Claus, you know, I'm kind of jumping around here, but like what I enjoy is as we go through this, like there's more kind of couple flashbacks here and there, Santa Claus talking about his history. Cause like for one, how old is this version of Saint Nick? And two, like, why does he speak English? That's something that never gets addressed and that's totally okay. But you find out that like this Santa is actually a Viking from like the 11th century and somehow he became Santa. But his primary weapon is a sledgehammer named Skull Crusher. So later on in the movie, when he needs to take out a bunch of terrorists, because now you've got like a military back. Think of like, okay, this movie not only rips off Die Hard. It very much, I don't want to say rip off, pay homage. It's definitely an homage. It pays homage to Die Hard 2 by having the same twist in Die Hard 2 with the good guys actually being the bad guys. And I saw that coming a mile away. Like when they called up this backup squad that's going to come, this extraction team that's going to come and like save the family. And we see them in the same kind of white camo that we saw from Die Hard 2. I'm just like, oh yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Like they're totally in on it. This movie isn't subtle and that's okay. But all that did is just add more cannon fodder for David Harbour to just brutalize. And he did in a scene in the garage. It's hysterical. Now, the whole other part of the movie, again, the whole other side of it, too, is like Scrooge, John Leguizamo's character, you know, he's taking this over because he wants the $300 million in cash that are in the family's vault, largely from defense contracts, right? That Gertrude had kind of like embezzled away. And he kind of imagines himself to be a bit of a Hans Gruber type. He knows everything. He's prepped and planned for every possible scenario. Right? There's no contingency that he doesn't have a solution for, except for Santa Claus showing up. And so when they capture Santa Claus and they start to interrogate him, and basically he kind of confirms that he's Santa Claus to them, like they kind of freak. And I thought that was really funny because he's like, wait, what the hell's going on here? Like, wait, are we actually fighting the real Santa Claus? I really enjoyed that because you're like, now everything's out of whack, right? Now everything's up in the air. And the family is trying to like, you know, keep their stuff together. You've got the sister, her like TikTok star of a son, Birdie, her boyfriend, Cam Giganet, who is an actor who wants to, you know, who wants to get Gertrude to fund his next movie. Like that's what he's there for, to try to like talk to his girlfriend's mom, who's super wealthy, to fund the next movie. And again, one of the things with that made me laugh is just remembering my time in LA and like how that kind of stuff would happen. And I'm pretty sure that Pat and Josh, the writers of the movie, were very much, you know, poking fun at scenarios that they've probably been a part of throughout their time working in the industry, about people just using every opportunity they can, regardless of how inappropriate it is, to try to get a movie bought and paid for. All right. Like I got some stories about that too. You know, you got to love that though. Now, what cracks me up is like, you know, Gertrude is trying to like work with Santa. She's doing her thing, but like Jason wants to, you know, he wants to be his own man. So we find out that he actually stole the $300 million from his mom, and he had let her know in a letter that he had done it and that he was going to leave. And she actually, you know what, keeps it to herself because she knows that if she exposes him, that's going to end up kind of destroying everything. But I think she also deep down has a little bit of respect for him because she kind of views him as being a bit of a pushover. And she doesn't really think that he's got the cojones to be the next person in line of succession. You know, and so I thought that was a cool little dynamic where she starts to kind of see like, oh, my son's got a, you know, he's got a little bit of hair on his scrot. All right, good for him. But of course, as you know, these movies tend to progress, it always kind of, you know, he ends up being tortured, kind of gives up where it's at. They all go through their whole nonsense. But what I love though is when the family finally starts fighting back, they kill one of the guards. And I was waiting for like a line to happen. I was waiting for just like a funny quip. And it was just like, Linda says, oh, it's nice to finally do things together as a family. They just murdered a guy. Right. But the guy was a piece of shit. So like, you know, you're fine with him dying. Right. So that part was kind of funny. And then they all kind of rush out to go and save Jason. And then, you know, here comes Santa and he's going to go and try to stop the bad guy who's getting away with the money. And he's just, you know, getting his revenge and everything else. And I have to say, the ending of the movie for me was pretty great. The movie was violent. The movie was very violent. And the movie definitely had a lot of great kills. And again, this is going to be an instant classic in my mind. I said that this year for holiday season, we had Spirited with Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds, and Violent Night are two movies that are just like wonderfully Christmas in my mind. Two instant classics, two very different movies, but very much instant classics. I really recommend Spirited if you haven't seen it. But like when he fights John Leguizamo, he's getting tore up because, you know, like there's an actual really good fight there. And then he grabs John Leguizamo and pulls him through the chimney and just eviscerates the body. And when that happened in my theater, I saw it with about 20 people. Everyone clapped. Everyone cheered. I was like, you'll never look at chimneys the same way again. Beautiful. It was wonderful. I loved it. And then, of course, you know, like the family kind of comes together. They take out the last bad guy. Santa Claus is dying, you know, and they kind of pull one of those like Tinkerbell, like clap and tell her you believe type moments. They're like, I believe in you, Santa. I believe in you. And then everyone's like, I believe in you. And then that gives him the power to kind of come back from the dead, you know, and then he takes off again to finish the job. And, you know, that's the movie. It was simple. It was effective. It was great. It was fun. And it's already on PVOD, like super quick, 3 weeks after it came out. So there's no reason why you guys can't go check it out right now. But look, I'm not the only one that liked this movie. The critics actually were very kind to it. Rotten Tomatoes said that critics didn't find the film as wildly entertaining as its concept might suggest, but they did give it a 73% out of 190 critics. It did get a 6.4 out of 10 on Metacritic, and it actually got a B+ on CinemaScore, which I don't understand. A B+? Really? After that ending, a B+? People are cray, I swear. But anyway, look, it might have only gotten a B+. It might have only gotten a 73%. But the box office absolutely agreed with this movie, even when it was up against Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. It had a $20 million budget. It grossed $13.5 million in its opening weekend. What you have to remember about that is its initial estimate was actually at like $8.8 million, and it did $13.5. The movie actually went on to do, I think, about, it's even right now, it's still in theaters right now, and it's at about $36.5 million. And I think it's at about 56 or 60 million worldwide. So on a $20 million budget, it's made back three times its budget. It's absolutely covered marketing costs. It's absolutely covered back its production budget three times over. It's done really well. And again, it's entirely available to check out on PVOD. It will be on home video soon enough because, you know, these kind of movies obviously are going to be I guess you could say time sensitive, but I feel like you could probably watch Violent Night even in the middle of July and be happy with it. So when I think about this movie as a whole package, as I get to the wrap up part of this podcast, I have to say that I love the simple approach. Yes, it is taking a kind of tried and true approach to this, the Die Hard effect, if you will. And they found a way to do it that's compelling. They found a way to bring in an actor like David Harbour, who probably really wanted something different than Hellboy, which is a movie that I do fundamentally like, and I will need to do a full episode breakdown on. But it's like they got a very compelling guy to play this role, to play Santa Claus. Not bitter, not cynical, not bad Santa, not fat man, but they played it relatively straight. A person who is just down, I don't want to say down on their luck, but they just like look at their job and they see it as thankless and they've been doing it for so long and that society is passing them by and that like everybody just wants an iPad, you know, or something not even like, you know, super compelling anymore. It's just all gadgets and gizmos and whatnot. And here he is just wanting something to believe in. And lo and behold, he finds himself in a hostage situation where the one girl there who believes in him needs him now more than ever. And so he ends up, you know, using that as motivation to remind himself why he is Santa Claus and why these mofos are going to die. What I hope for the future, because like the movie has done well enough to warrant more, and I think the writers have said that they want to go and do more. There's been some online speculation about whether or not like they're going to tell more of these stories in like an interconnected kind of like a holiday figure type world, right? Think like Easter Bunny, Tooth Fairy, you know, Cupid, leprechauns, Jack Frost, right? I mean, think like a more violent version of the Santa Claus 2, essentially. I could see them doing something like that and having these characters end up in very similar situations. And then maybe, just maybe, if the franchise has legs, working itself towards some kind of Avengers Endgame type scenario where you've got all of these mythical creatures that have to, for some reason, come together to save the world. Maybe. I don't even know. But if they don't move away from the simple concept and they don't try to go too far with it too fast and they don't try to expand the world too much in the sequel, I think things will actually work out okay. And I'm going to use another Universal movie as a bit of an example of this, and that's Trolls. So Trolls in 2016 is a movie that I love. I think it's wonderfully funny. I love the music. I love everything about it. I was very excited for Trolls World Tour when it came out in 2020 at the start of the pandemic. Trolls World Tour, the biggest problem with that is it tried to expand the world too much too quick. And it ended up spending so much time trying to do that, it took away from the core characters that we care about that we're following through this journey. And a lot of sequels tend to do that. Even Black Panther Wakanda Forever, despite having Chadwick Boseman, you know, be dead in real life, unfortunately, still suffered from a very similar problem. These movies don't need to show us everything around them. They just need to capture what was so great about the original. And I think a lot of that has to do with like executives that are like bigger, bolder, crazier. If it's bigger, bolder, crazier, we're going to end up getting a bigger budget or a bigger box office. But if you take a look, for example, and again, Avatar The Way of Water. Avatar The Way of Water takes the Sully clan, moves them from the forest, puts them near the ocean. Same enemy type, right? Same kind of reason why they're fighting the enemy. Doesn't really change much. Doesn't reinvent the wheel. But it's compelling because the characters are now in a very similar situation that they have acknowledged and experience from, but they still are dealing with challenges that are not only facing them in regards to the enemy, but also the family dynamic. And it makes a more compelling, bigger movie, but one that still feels relatively smaller in scope. And I think that if they focus on that, we'll get something out of Violent Night 2 that can be up there with some of the greats. At least I hope. But even if it fails, it doesn't really matter. I still have this great little movie that is fun to watch, fun to talk about. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If you have a movie you want me to talk about, let me know. If you're listening to this on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast, please leave a review. It really does help out. Check out Podio Commentary on YouTube. That is where I do my reviews and also post these long form discussions. And I'll talk to you guys later. Have yourself a great day. Thank you again for watching. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, and peace out.